Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. Happy New Year. Long before the most recent wave of same-sex unions, Americans formed a wide range of extra-legal partnerships that included common domicile, sexual relations, and parenting, sometimes crossing genders. Our guest this week, Estelle Friedman, has written a short history of such partnerships, and she'll be here in a few minutes to discuss that history. Kathleen Dalton will be joining us to compare our moral anxieties over gay marriage with similar concerns among progressives at the start of the 20th century. And Alex Burza will return with another of his historical and sometimes hysterical hoaxes. But first, let's look at a few items of historical interest in the news. For more than 50 years, rancher Waldo Wilcox, now 74 years old, kept most outsiders off his property and unaware of a secret on that land. The secret was a string of ancient Indian settlements so well preserved that arrowheads and beads were lying in the open. Archaeologists are calling it one of the most spectacular finds in the West. Hidden deep inside Utah's nearly inaccessible Book Cliffs region, 130 miles from Salt Lake City, the prehistoric villages run for 12 miles and include hundreds of rock art panels, cliffside granaries, stone houses built halfway underground, rock shelters, and the mummified remains of long-ago inhabitants. The site was occupied for at least 3,000 years until it was abandoned about 1,000 years ago when the Fremont people mysteriously vanished. The secret is only now coming to light after the federal and state governments paid Wilcox $2.5 million for the ranch. The state has taken ownership. And for those violin lovers out there, the secret of a Stradivarius violin's heavenly sound may now be known. For centuries, experts have debated whether special varnishes or wood treatments were the secret to the instrument's rich resonance, which some consider superior to contemporary violins. Recently, however, a tree ring dating expert at the University of Tennessee and a climatologist at Columbia University offered a new theory, namely that the wood developed special acoustic properties as it was growing because of an extended period of long winters and cool summers. "It just amazed me that no one had thought of this before," said Henry Grissino Mayer. "The relationship between the violin, the trees that they were made from, the climate that existed when the trees grew, and how it affected wood density to create superior tonal quality." Grissino Mayer at Tennessee and Lloyd Burkle at Columbia suggest a little ice age that gripped Europe from the mid-1400s until the mid-1800s slowed tree growth and yielded uncommonly dense alpine spruce, which was used by the famous Italian violin maker Antonio Stradivari. Stradivari produced his most prized violins between 1700 and 1720. When we return, Estelle Friedman and I discussed historical alternatives to mainstream marriages. Kathleen Dalton tells us about how Theodore Roosevelt sought to protect traditional marriages. And Alex Burza presents another of his hoaxes from history, this one titled The Fortis Biblio Hoax. This is Talking History. In light of the Massachusetts State Court decision allowing gay marriages, the Organization of American Historians, at its meeting in Boston in March 2004, added a session titled The Peculiar Institution of Marriage. Our guest this week, Estelle Friedman, was asked to provide examples of same-sex union in the past. She later expanded the charge to include alternatives to marriage and to provide historical perspectives on the contemporary social movement for marriage equality. That resulted in an article in the OEH newsletter of August 2004, Boston Marriage, Free Love, and Fictive Kin, Historical Alternatives to Mainstream Marriage. Welcome, Estelle.
Thank you.
What did you hope to accomplish by writing this history of alternatives to traditional marriage?
Well, quite honestly, I wanted to expand the historical repertoire for thinking about long-term committed unions in light of what's going on today. And as you mentioned, when I was asked to find examples of same-sex unions in the past, I felt that wasn't really going far enough, that we really need to think about how unions looked different from all kinds of perspectives, including critics of marriage in the past, not only those who were trying to emulate marriage when they were excluded from it.
Okay, and among the practices you discuss in your article, you include gender crossing, for example, and give some historical examples of this. Tell us about Mrs. Nash.
Mrs. Nash was married several times out in the Western Territories to soldiers in the forts in that area, and it wasn't until her death that they realized Mrs. Nash was, in fact, born male. And we don't know if the men who married Mrs. Nash were intending to be in a same-sex union or whether they were surprised to find this out. But it's an example of people who passed for the other gender in the 19th century, something that was often reported in newspapers, particularly of women passing as men.
You also write about men or women who retained their gender identity, but still established marriage-like relationships long before the current move in that direction.
That's right. It wasn't only when a woman pretended to be a man and then became a husband, but sometimes two women would set up a household together or two men would set up a household together. And in fact, there was a phenomenon that was so frequent in one northeastern city of college-educated women who would form a union, share domicile, share a bedroom, take their vacations. The family knew them as a couple, that it was called a Boston marriage, partly because there were so many college-educated women in the Boston area.
What I found interesting about that is it really didn't create much of a scandal.
Not in the late 19th century, because of the assumption that these women were chaste. That is, if there wasn't a man in the house, they couldn't be having sex. So that they were spinsters, that they were simply good friends. Some of them, I'm sure, were, but some of them could have also had a sexual component to their relationship. Until the early 20th century, they were not necessarily interrogated in terms of whether they were sinning sexually.
And that was the point at which the whole idea of homosexuality caught up with such unions?
In a sense, that's correct. The very concept homosexuality did not emerge until the late 19th century in the sexological literature that was coming out of Europe and then popularized in the United States. And by the early 20th century, you begin to have an identity of homosexuality. Many theories about whether it's biological and whether it's natural or unnatural and whether it's curable or not. But increasingly in the early 20th century, it's a stigmatized identity. And ironically, you might say, as for some women, the so-called sexual revolution acknowledged sexual desire, for women whose sexual desire didn't take the normative direction of heterosexuality, another term that's invented at the time, there was more of a barrier or a boundary, more of a stigma associated with same-sex desire. So women living together in the early 20th century had to be very careful to make sure they had those separate beds or to make sure that people knew they weren't sleeping together in a way that women earlier used to share beds without it necessarily being assumed they might be sexual.
Interesting. Okay, so far we've been talking about practices, but this wasn't just a matter of practice. People actually took time to think this through and write about it. And one of the things you talk about in the 19th century is how this worked into utopian ideas. Tell us how the idea of sexuality and marriage was taken in that context.
Well, here's where we get to the critics. That is, not only do you have some people establishing marriage-like institutions, Boston marriage or men who might have lived together, you also had some, what we would later call heterosexuals, saying marriage itself was something they did not want to partake in. And I'm thinking here of the utopian free lovers, those who felt everyone should be free to have a union without the church or the state sanctioning it. Now, free love did not mean promiscuity. It meant you chose a mate, you lived together like marriage, you have children together, but why should the state or the church have to say who you could be with? In fact, some of these writers considered marriage a form of prostitution because it gave a husband the right to have sex with a wife, whether she wanted to or not. people like Francis Wright in the early 19th century, Marx, Edgeworth, Lazarus writing in the 1850s about whether marriage is really a form of prostitution, and some of the free lovers in the late 19th century who went to jail rather than have a marriage ceremony, or who went to jail for writing critically about marriage or what we would today call marital rape, really stood up for their beliefs and paid.
Okay, that's a key point. We want to come back to that later because you have some interesting things to say about where these unions stand now. But let's take you into the 20th century here. And you write that by the early decades of the 20th century, gay and lesbian subcultures formed in the nation's largest cities, expanding the opportunities for same-sex unions. Tell us how that came about.
Well, over the course of the late 19th century, the early 20th century, when we have a more urban society, more wage earners who are able to live apart from family in more anonymous cities, you do begin to find communities forming in New York City, for example, or in probably Chicago, Washington. We have some people who observe. There are men who get together in certain parks or certain baths, and you're beginning to have an urban space, an urban geography that's the forerunner of later 20th century lesbian, gay, urban communities and subcultures. Sometimes they're more private than visible, maybe house parties. By the mid-20th century, there's a whole bar culture. We know that in some large cities like New York, there was even some tolerance for some of the cross-dressing practices or some of the fascination in nightclub life with people who were sort of on the margins of bohemian worlds and also might overlap with this emerging homosexual subculture. So very slow to come to smaller towns in the United States, I would say, even today. But by the 1920s, 1930s, you could find gay and lesbian subcultures in quite a number of America's large cities. And, of course, when people are in a subculture and beginning to identify as lesbian, gay, homosexual, there may be more opportunities. You go to the bar, you meet somebody, you go to the party, you meet someone, you make eye contact on the street or in the park, and you begin to have more possibilities that they may become relationships. I just want to say that at this time in the early 20th century, the stigma is still so strong, as especially for men, these meetings often have to be so surreptitious that there's a disincentive to acknowledging or to entering into long-term relationships, and that's something that's going to change later in the century.
Let's move up to later in the century, because I think you make, to me, a very interesting historical point here. You start off by saying that the institution of marriage remains, as you put it, a privileged site for heterosexual unions. But then you take up a very interesting subject here, which is that much of what we've been talking about has constituted an attack on the institution of marriage, largely for what was seen as its patriarchal trappings. But now we're seeing a mass movement by same-sex couples not to topple the institution, but to extend it or its privileges to themselves. So have same-sex couples now come to embrace the institution?
Well, some have and some haven't. And the historical point, I think, is that the change in the late 20th century from the stigmatized identity, the underground subcultures, to gay liberation, embracing a gay or lesbian identity openly, beginning to have laws passed, more tolerance, in a sense, made it more easy or at least encouraged long-term couple formation. Once you begin to get long-term couple formation, yes, I think a number of people, in fact, mass numbers clearly, seek the privileges of marriage. Now, we talked about those free lovers who had criticized marriage in the 19th century. Well, early gay liberationists, say, in the late 1960s, the early 1970s, also considered marriage a patriarchal institution. But by the 1980s and by the 1990s, you don't hear that radical critique so much, the smash monogamy and smash marriage. You actually have thousands and thousands of couples settling down, having a mortgage, having a long-term relationship, and thinking of themselves like married couples, but without the benefits that married couples had. So you have, on the one hand, this proliferation of same-sex partnerships. At the same time, and I think this is also important to the story, marriage has changed. Marriage is less patriarchal than it once was, certainly in the 18th or 19th century, when a husband really could rule over the wife and the children, the servants, and in some areas, the slaves. Increasingly, you have a more companionate or egalitarian model for marriage. You no longer have the husband's rule over the wife. So marriage looks different, and more same-sex couples look like married couples.
You indicate that there's at least three measures that you put forward that illustrate this changing meaning of marriage. Let's talk about maybe each one of them briefly. Reproduction,
okay,
no longer being a primary function through the life of marriage.
Sure. In 1800 or 1900, marriage looks different than it does in the year 2000. In 1800, the average married woman during her reproductive years bore 8 children. She died pretty young, too. Most of her married life was spent bearing and rearing children. 1900, average 4 children. 2000, average 2 children. And some people choose not to have children. So there's no longer this strong correlation between being married and constantly bearing children.
Woman working?
Well, increasingly in the 20th century, more and more women, married women, and mothers of children are wage earners. This gives them some leverage in terms of leaving unhappy or abusive relationships, or even entering marriage later, entering marriage by choice, not necessity. So marriage is not just purely reproductive, it is more by choice.
And the fact that the state is expanding benefits to those in legal unions?
Well, yes, the state has become more important over the course of the 20th century in constructing much of our lives. So tax law, for example, or immigration policy depend upon your marital status, your filing status for taxes, or inheritance for children, or whether a partner who you marry can come into this country as an immigrant. True for married couples, not true for same-sex unions.
How important has the AIDS crisis been in all of this?
I think that's a really good point, because when I gave that sort of sweeping background of gay liberation and this sort of shift towards stable unions, we really didn't talk about this major historical event of AIDS in the 1980s. And I think for a couple of reasons. For one, so many people coming out during that crisis by necessity, but also others because it had become a public issue. And also so many partners of those with AIDS who were denied visitation rights or who lost what had been common property because they were not legally protected, all of that brought up issues of partner rights. And I think it also made more poignant the issues, I'll take a movie like Philadelphia, where people began to realize there are long-term committed couples who are suffering from certain legal disabilities. And actually, there's one other thing that we should talk about. I may be anticipating here your own questions, but it's not only the AIDS crisis, but something else was happening in the 80s and 90s that's sometimes called the gay boom, that is the gay baby boom. And more lesbians and to some extent gay men were choosing to become parents within these committed relationships. So it's not only the tragedy of AIDS, but also bringing new life, raising children, sometimes adopting, sometimes through artificial insemination or multiple parenting arrangements. And in the same way that AIDS highlighted the needs for rights for couples, so has gay parenting, second parent adoptions, for example, and all kinds of issues of inheritance. So the legal rights become necessitated by these social changes.
Okay, you did anticipate, and that's great, and I think we're going to have to leave it there.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Estelle Friedman, Edgar E. Robinson Professor in U.S. History at Stanford University. Professor Friedman is the author of Boston Marriage, Free Love, and Fictive Kin, Historical Alternatives to Mainstream Marriage, which appeared in the August 2004 issue of the Organization of American Historians newsletter. She's also the author of No Turning Back, The History of Feminism and the Future of Woman, published by Ballantine Books. This is Talking History. Commentary of the Week, continuing on the theme of alternative marriages, Kathleen Dalton shows us that in some ways recent concerns with and attempts to protect traditional marriages are not entirely new. She offers us a historical parallel in a commentary she titles Theodore Roosevelt on Gay Marriage. Dalton is co-director of the Bray Center and instructor of history at Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts. She's also the author of Theodore Roosevelt, A Strenuous Life.
Gay marriage. The current debate over our moral trouble resonates with progressive moral anxieties that troubled Theodore Roosevelt and his reform allies. But the danger to the moral fiber of America 100 years ago was not gay marriage. Marriage was under siege in those days, but its imagined attackers were different villains. Moral reform groups like the Women's Christian Temperance Union, WCTU, believed marriage was jeopardized by Mormons who practiced polygamy. They had objected to Utah being admitted to the Union as a state because they believed women were oppressed by plural marriage. The Senate for a while refused to seat Utah Senator Reed Smoot over the polygamy issue. Theodore Roosevelt, as president, opposed polygamy because he believed marriage should be between one man and one woman, not one man and several women. TR also opposed easy divorce, as did many religious groups, including the National League for the Protection of the Family and the Interfaith Committee on Marriage and Divorce, because they believed it weakened the bonds of marriage. Roosevelt especially hated the people of his own class, upper that is, who engaged in scandalous affairs and then went to Reno to rid themselves of a succession of spouses. He took marriage seriously and believed that socialites did not, so he wanted to make it harder to get a divorce. On December 3, 1906, in his sixth message to Congress, as State of the Union addresses were known at the time, President Theodore Roosevelt proposed a constitutional amendment to protect marriage. The amendment was designed to defend the institution and to standardize American moral practices. It did not pass. Does anyone seriously believe that we will strengthen the institution of marriage by passing a constitutional amendment to keep a small group of people from getting married? I personally favor marriage and lifelong commitment as good institutions for most people, and I recommend it to my gay and lesbian friends who have long-standing loving relationships. It seems to me the federal and state governments should support legal attempts for people to maintain deep, loving commitments toward each other, especially where there are children involved. So although I would concede that many progressives like TR would probably line up behind President Bush's moral grandstanding in an election year, I think they would be wrong. In fact, what they are doing is pandering to the homophobes and gay bashers who constitute more of a threat to our society than the couples who want legal rights to marry.
You've been listening to Kathleen Dalton, co-director of the Brace Center and instructor of history at Phillips Academy, and the author of Theodore Roosevelt, A Strenuous Life. In a moment, Alex Berza. This is Talking History. As promised, Alex Berza is back with another of his wonderful hoaxes from the past. Berza, you may recall, is the author of The Museum of Hoaxes, a collection of pranks, stunts, deceptions, and other wonderful stories contrived for the public from the Middle Ages to the new millennium. This week, Berza takes us back to 19th century Europe and what he calls a bibliohoax.
Jean Nepomucène Auguste Pichard, Comte de Forçats, was a man with a singular passion. He collected books of which only one copy was known to exist. If he ever discovered that one of the volumes in his library had a duplicate anywhere in the world, he would immediately dispose of it. So when he died on September 1, 1839, he possessed only 52 books, but each of them was absolutely unique. His heir, not sharing the old man's passion for book collecting, decided to auction off the books. And a catalog describing this small but highly unusual library was mailed to book collectors throughout Europe. The auction was scheduled to be held in Binche, Belgium, on August 10, 1840. When Europe's librarians and intellectuals received the catalog, they could hardly believe their eyes. The books would have been valuable even if duplicate copies had existed, but the fact that each one of them was unique made them priceless. On August 10th, the collectors descended on Binche like a pack of vultures, eager to pick clean the entire library. The Belgian government even sent an official representative, believing that the collection was so valuable that it should be bought in its entirety and kept in the country. But only disappointment greeted the hopeful buyers. They found notices posted around the town announcing that the public library of Binche had acquired the entire collection. Some of the collectors returned home, but others stayed, curious to view the unique books in their new home. But it didn't take long for them to discover that there was no Binche public library. Then the full realization dawned on them. There was no Comte de Fort Saas either. The entire auction and list of unique books had been an enormous, elaborately designed hoax. The man behind the hoax was a local antiquarian named Renier Hubert Ghislain Chalon. The planning that had gone into the deception was incredible. He had carefully researched the interests of all the major bibliophiles in Europe in order to guarantee the maximum amount of interest in the auction. And why had he done all this? For one simple reason. He enjoyed playing pranks on intellectuals. But the hoax proved not to be a total loss for some of its victims. The catalog they had received itself became a highly coveted collector's item. Within a few decades, it had more than quadrupled in price, rewarding those who had had the foresight to purchase multiple copies of this catalog of fictitious, one-of-a-kind books.
You've been listening to Alex Berza, author of The Museum of Hoaxes, published by Dutton Books, and the curator of the virtual museum of the same title, which you can find at www.museumofhoaxes.com. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As usual, we remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that our producer is Fiona Beattie, that our studio engineer is Alex Smith, and that the opinions offered by our guests on Talking History do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And finally, we invite you to send us your comments on this show by email, if you wish, to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.